Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman reporting the United States will delay removing its troops from Afghanistan. U.S. President Barack Obama says he will delay the planned withdrawal of American military forces from Afghanistan scheduled for next year as the Taliban makes gains there that the U.S. was not anticipating.
I've decided to maintain our current posture of 9,800 troops in Afghanistan through most of next year, 2016. Their mission will not change. Our troops will continue to pursue those two narrow tasks that I outlined earlier, training Afghan forces and going after al-Qaeda. But maintaining our current posture through most of next year, rather than a more rapid drawdown, will allow us to sustain our efforts to train and assist Afghan forces as they grow stronger. Not only during this fighting season, but into the next one.
Speaking at the White House Thursday, Obama said he will maintain the current number of troops in the war-torn country to 9,800 through most of the 2016 year before trimming that number to 5,500 by the time he leaves office in January of 2017. He said the security situation in key areas of the country remains very fragile and there is risk of deterioration. One day after the U.S. and Russia wrapped up a third round of lower-level talks on rules for conduct in the air over Syria, Russian President Vladimir Putin is slamming the U.S. stance on the conflict as unconstructive after Washington declined to take part in high-level bilateral negotiations on the coordination of military activity in Syria. This is VOA News. Authorities in Turkey have released the identities of two suicide bombers who attacked a peace rally in the capital of Ankara on Saturday.
Quoting police officials, Turkish media say one of Saturday's bombers is the brother of a suicide bomber who killed 33 pro-Kurdish activists in the Turkish town of Suruç near the Syrian border in July. Turkish security forces blamed that attack on the Islamic State group, although there was no claim of responsibility. The second attacker was on a police list of suspected Islamic State suicide bombers. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu revealed the existence of the list earlier this week, but claimed the suspects could not be detained as they had not committed a crime. The revelations will likely lead to more allegations of negligence by the government over the bombings, a charge it denies. Turkish media quote police sources as saying both men travelled to Ankara from the Turkish city of Gaziantep, close to the Syrian border, prior to Saturday's attack. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Myanmar's government and eight smaller ethnic rebel armies signed a ceasefire agreement to end more than six decades of fighting, but other more powerful groups refused to come on board, signaling that peace most likely will remain elusive for some time to come. The pact was signed in a ceremony in Myanmar's administrative capital, Naypyidaw, by President Thein Sein and representatives of the groups. The refusal by the larger armies, such as those of the Kachin and Hua ethnic groups, to sign it robs Thein Sein of what he had hoped would be the crowning achievement of his five-year term. Larry Jagan has been studying Myanmar from inside the country for a number of years now.
It can't be considered a nationwide ceasefire agreement, but it is the start of a process that might actually lead to all the ethnic groups signing the ceasefire agreement. Most of them already have bilaterals, and this is trying to bring them all together to start a political dialogue process.
Ethnic groups representing 40% of the country's 52 million people have found themselves victims of military abuses and discrimination in areas spanning from health and education to road construction and access to electricity. U.S. State Department suggestions that Israel might be using excessive force to confront a wave of Palestinian stabbing attacks has drawn sharp criticism from senior Israeli cabinet ministers. Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon accused Washington of misreading the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He said shooting knife-wielding Palestinians was self-defense. Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan called the U.S. remarks foolish. China says it has not militarized the South China Sea and warned certain countries to stop hyping up the issue. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Well, I think when we look at what's happening in Europe now, and it's been happening really for months, we do start to see immediate comparisons of a sort of fearful public who's facing, in some instances, an economic crisis.
That's Loren Lindau of the African Center for Migration and Society. He compares the European migrant and refugee crisis to South Africa's recent migrant influx from Zimbabwe.
Also, the leading opponent to President Alpha Conde's re-election bid in Guinea has withdrawn from the race and charged fraud in last Sunday's vote. Niger declares a state of emergency in its southeastern region bordering Nigeria, often targeted by Boko Haram militants.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Mali, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour: in Guinea, the leading opponent to President Alpha Conde's re-election bid reportedly has withdrawn from the race and charged fraud in last Sunday's vote. The campaign director for Seloun Dalein Diallo announced Diallo's withdrawal from the race today. He said the candidate will not recognize the results of what could turn out to be a close election. Early vote counting shows Mr. Conde in the lead with at least 55% of the vote. Some analysts predict the final count will be so close that Mr. Conde may have to participate in a runoff vote with Diallo. Diallo is an economist and former prime minister. Mr. Conde is seeking a second five-year term. His 2010 election ended 2 years of military rule.
Reuters news agency reports Niger has declared a state of emergency in a southeastern region bordering Nigeria. The area has been targeted by Boko Haram militants. The 15-day emergency order imposes a nighttime curfew and restricts the movement of goods and people. More than 40 civilians have died in the Difa region in recent attacks on villages and cities. Since February, Difa residents have suffered 57 attacks. Security forces have arrested more than 1,100 terrorism suspects.
At least 8 migrants... At least 8 migrants and refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea today when their wooden boat collided with a Greek Coast Guard vessel. In the past 24 hours, the Coast Guard has rescued about 830 people. In Finland, authorities arrested 15 suspects for smuggling. Officials described them as Iraqis living in Finland or Sweden. More than 22,000 asylum seekers, mostly Iraqis, have arrived in Finland this year. The AP says heads of Interpol and Europe's Europol have identified expanding networks of organized crime syndicates smuggling migrants into Europe. The two law enforcement agencies met in Berlin with counterparts from 50 countries to deal with new crime syndicate operations.
European leaders dealing with the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis could learn some lessons from South Africa. South Africa faced its own migrant and asylum seeker crisis in recent years when many Zimbabweans fled their homeland during an economic downturn. There were massive bureaucratic problems as well as xenophobic violence. Loren Landau is a researcher with the African Center for Migration and Society at the University of Witwatersrand. From Johannesburg, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapawa about what could be done to help ease the European crisis.
Well, I think when we look at what's happening in Europe now, and it's been happening really for months, we do start to see immediate comparisons of a sort of fearful public who's facing, in some instances, an economic crisis, and a government response which is confused and mixed with a kind of humanitarian impulse, but also a deep economic and physical security impulse. And then our question is, okay, well, South Africa has been dealing with the same thing for a long time, and what could we learn from that?
What were the biggest problems South Africa faced with the influx from Zimbabwe?
South Africa in some ways faced very few problems at a kind of economic level. Zimbabweans came in, many found jobs, and many were able to contribute, but there was a perception problem, which is, I think, also what's driving the response in Europe, a sense that foreigners were bringing crime, foreigners were bringing disease, foreigners were likely to affect local cultures, and certainly foreigners were going to take away jobs. And as a result, what we saw was a very strong anti-foreigner response from the government and even stronger, sometimes violent response from local politicians and citizens.
I remember there were some bureaucratic nightmares as well as the xenophobic violence. Do you foresee that happening on a wide scale in Europe?
Well, what we've seen in South Africa, and I think what we're already starting to see in Europe, is a underground economy for documents. When you try to give one small group of people legal rights and exclude everyone else, you create a scarce resource that has enormous value. And what we've seen in South Africa is deep-seated corruption emerge around refugee documents. And I think we've started to see some of this already happening as Europe has sought to control the influx of people into its territory.
You mentioned this in your article on the problems in South Africa. We're seeing it in Europe. You have the asylum seekers, the economic migrants, and now a new class called climate migrants who are fleeing areas affected by climate change. Is there a problem when you have so many divisions?
Well, I think what we're seeing is an effort to try to categorize complex phenomena which mix environment, mix politics, mix economics into neat bureaucratic categories. That might have worked in the past. I'm not sure that it ever worked very well. But increasingly, it's difficult to differentiate those populations, and states are struggling to do so. And unfortunately, they haven't yet found a way of thinking about this in slightly different ways.
So what did South Africa do right after several years of facing this problem to sort of calm the situation?
Well, I think South Africa continues to be in a deep-seated crisis around migration. There's been increased raids on police, moves on behalf of politicians to try to take away the rights of refugees and also to exclude new migrants. There are some people in civil society who have been saying, look, migration is natural. We need the skills. We need the resources. We need the trade. But those voices are often being drowned out by groups who say we must protect our rights, we must protect our cultures and our economy.
Now, in South Africa, it was basically South Africa and Zimbabwe. When you look at Europe, you have the entire European bloc, and then you have migrants coming from many different countries. Does that add to the problems of trying to deal with this crisis?
Well, South Africa has received immigrants from around the region and as far away as China and Bangladesh, but you're right, most have been regional. Obviously, in Europe, you're dealing with an issue of people coming from perhaps different cultural backgrounds, different religious backgrounds. However, Europe has already become a deeply multicultural society, as much as some people might like to deny it. And so in that sense, there's a kind of reaction to people coming from diverse places, very different backgrounds. But I think there's also, among some, a recognition that this is what Europe is going to look like in the years ahead.
So what do you foresee European countries doing to deal with this issue on a long-term basis?
So what I would hope to see, and I'm not sure that this will happen, is that people develop more pragmatic migration policies that don't try to make these very strict and clear differentiations, but also think about providing incentives at a local level for integration. People are often very scared of migrants coming in. People are frightened that they're going to steal their jobs, their resources. But if other sorts of resources can be directed, if communities can be empowered to absorb people, I think that that could help to assuage many of those concerns.
Do the migrants actually steal the jobs of the local population?
Whether you look at research from the United States, from the UK, across Europe, or even South Africa, what we tend to see is that migrants do tend to suppress wages in certain areas, but on aggregate, they tend to bring skills, they tend to create jobs. And in an area like Europe, where you have a declining population in many countries, they're going to provide the tax base and the resource base to take care of the elderly and to take care of the citizens.
Lauren Landau is with the African Center for Migration and Society from Johannesburg. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehaya Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. In more- more developments, the AP says an Egyptian court has acquitted the brother of al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri of charges of terrorism. Mohammed al-Zawahiri was arrested 2 years ago at a checkpoint in Cairo. At the same trial, the court sentenced 10 of his 67 co-defendants to death and gave life sentences to 32. Al-Zawahiri was a close ally of former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi and was charged with organizing a terrorist organization to overthrow the government.
Today is World Hand Washing Day. 7 years ago, health campaigners, including UNICEF and the U.S. Agency for International Development, decided October 15th to remind the world of the health benefits of hand sanitation. UNICEF has estimated 3.5 million children die annually from diarrheal diseases and pneumonia. Regular hand washing with soap could save up to 30% of those lives. Nick Long has more on hand washing campaign in the eastern DRC city of Goma.
A song blares out from a truck trailer in Goma. Aimed at mothers, it tells them to wash their hands with soap at five key moments: before cooking, before giving food to their children, before eating, after going to the bathroom, and after cleaning their children. And if they don't have soap, they can also use ashes. A popular comedian here, Jazza Jazza, leads the campaign from the trailer, singing, dancing and dispensing health advice. There's no connection between your children teething and diarrhea, he tells parents. No, Mama, it's the dirt under your fingernails. The American aid organization Mercy Corps says a recent survey found less than a third of the population here wash their hands at all the five moments, including before giving food to their children, for example. And few people use soap at all the five moments. I know many of you have toilets, says Jazza Jazza, but if I offered you $20, I bet you couldn't show me a toilet with soap next to it. A Mercy Corps survey found there are several obstacles to hand washing besides lack of access to water. Many people said they simply forget or it's not in their culture. But water access is a major problem in Goma, where the water utilities network was wrecked by a volcanic eruption in 2002. Recently, Mercy Corps put in 52 tap stands around town. The price of water at those stands is equivalent to about 5 US cents per 20 litres, compared with 30 or 40 US cents that truck and motorbike water vendors were charging. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Police report warns that Africa will not solve chronic food shortages and unemployment unless youth get involved in agriculture. Status report, Youth in Agriculture in Sub-Saharan Africa was developed by the Alliance for a Green Revolution, AGRA, an African-led alliance focused on putting farmers at the center of the continent's growing economy. The study was launched at the African Green Revolution Forum in Lusaka, Zambia. Dr. David Sarfo Ameya is managing editor of the report and AGRA's head of strategy. He says the study revealed that many young Africans view working in agriculture as drudgery.
This continent has two advantages. One is the young gene of the youth population in sub-Saharan Africa. While all other continent population are aging, Africa population is younger. And when we talk about that, we are saying that Africa has reached a peak of the share of persons between 15 to 24, and this peak is projected to continue to 2050.
While Ameya says this peak is projected well into the future, he also points out one troubling aspect, that millions of Africa's farmers are relying on imports to feed their families.
The continent faces two major problems. One is food insecurity, and two is unemployment. And the crux of the report is that if governments, policymakers, practitioners, stakeholders can tap into the youth dividend that this continent is experiencing, we will be able to solve the food insecurity, unemployment, and poverty problems on this continent.
Ameya says the study revealed that the agriculture sector is a hard sell for young Africans, particularly those who are educated. For example, it found that only 9% of youth in Ethiopia said they planned to work in agriculture. However, a majority of Nigeria's youth viewed a career in agriculture as favorable. This may be due to the country's effort at making agriculture a more attractive field for young people to pursue. However, Ameya pointed out several major challenges young people face. The first is access to land.
What we propose on access to land is that there should be a creation of land markets where people who are willing to sell and people who are willing to buy will have a good transaction and will have the information that will promote it.
The other challenges he listed included making the land that young people have inherited from their parents more productive, a need for government policies that will allow for the availability of land for young people to use for food production, credit for land, and risk management services.
The report points out that unlike the United States and other places where young people, as soon as they enter college, they start building their credit reports. In Africa, less than 20% of the young people have access to, and when we talk about access to, we are talking about either having a bank account or having any form of credit from the bank. We saw that 90% of young people under the age of 35 have been accessing credit, but none of the credits they are accessing are from the financial institution. They are either from their mother, their father, friends, or other family.
Ameya says the creation of a credit system is a big key in getting young people interested in agriculture. He says access to working capital will help them establish creative and dynamic opportunities along the agriculture value chain. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
A new study finds the Ebola virus can persist in the semen of male survivors months after the recovery from the deadly disease. 93 men participated in the study, which was conducted jointly by the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health and Sanitation, the World Health Organization, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Researchers looked at the presence of Ebola in the semen of men who had been declared free of the disease. Nathalie Brouté is the WHO's medical officer and one of the study's lead authors. She tells VOA the semen of the 93 participants was tested at different stages after recovery to see how long the virus persists.
We found presence of Ebola virus in the semen up to 9 months. So for these men that have positive semen, there is a risk of exposure to the virus for their sexual partners.
Brouté says the focus of the study is on the persistence of the Ebola virus in semen, not on the risk of transmission. She says the possible sexual transmission of the virus from the semen of survivors to their partners and the magnitude of that risk will be analyzed in another study. This study shows the virus remains considerably longer in semen than previously thought, but the concentration of the virus declines in the months after recovery from Ebola. It finds a very high presence of the virus in the semen 3 months after recovery. This decreases drastically after 6 months of survival. Brouté says it is still not known how long it takes for the virus to disappear completely. Therefore, she says, WHO recommends survivors receive support, appropriate and continuing counseling and follow-up testing. She says in the first 3 months after recovery, male survivors should abstain from sex or use condoms. Brouté says a major study to begin at the end of the month will look at the persistence of Ebola in 7 body fluids among 240 men and women survivors. These include tears, sweat, vaginal secretions, semen, rectal swabs, urine, and menstrual blood. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Timbuktu's historic mausoleums destroyed during the Islamist occupation of the northern Mali city have risen from the ruins. Local builders pressed ahead with efforts to rebuild the structures, even as the UN struggles to raise money for the campaign. Katerina Hoya reports from Timbuktu.
Alassane Hassay, the head mason of Timbuktu, gently unwraps a piece of his turban.
Maître, ça c'est le français. Avant ça, nous, on mesure qu'avec la main, et puis le turban.
This is a half a meter. Unfolded, it's 1 meter, he says. Before the French arrived and we switched to the metric system, builders used the turbans to measure the houses. When efforts by the UN to restore the mausoleums destroyed by jihadists dragged on, Mr. Hassay, a traditional builder, decided to take matters into his own hands. Starting with the library next to the historic Djengabe Mosque, he began to rebuild what occupiers had torn down.
Et c'est pour nous. C'est nous qui ont été torturés ici.
When they began the destruction of Timbuktu, we, the population, suffered, he says. We tried to tell them that this is part of the world heritage, but they wouldn't listen, and you don't fight someone holding a gun. When the Islamists finally left, we didn't have the means to rebuild the mausoleums, says Hassay. The jihadists destroyed a total of 40 mausoleums in Timbuktu during the occupation of the city and others in northern Mali during 2012. Recently, an alleged Islamic fighter charged with the destruction of the mausoleums and a mosque appeared at the International Criminal Court. The 40-year-old civil servant is the first suspect in the court's custody charged with the war crime of attacking religious or historical monuments. Human rights groups have welcomed the arrest of the alleged attacker while urging prosecutors to file more charges against him, including rape and forced marriage.
Ils ont occupé le stade, ils se sont installés au stade, ils ont pris ce qu'ils ont pris. Ils ont brûlé ce qu'ils ont brûlé.
The Islamists took what they wanted, they looted and pillaged, but they also committed crimes that were far more serious than the burning of, for example, the manuscripts, says Mohamed Diallo, the caretaker of a small library in Timbuktu. Timbuktu is a historic center of Islamic learning and listed as a World Heritage Site. When the jihadists forced their harsh version of Islamic law on the population, they also took away part of the city's soul, says Ibrahima Fofana with the government's World Heritage Department.
Je dirais, tous, comment dirais-je, le tissu socio-économique a été atteint. Donc,
social and financial structures were disrupted during the occupation, he says. It's not just about restoring historic buildings, but to regain our heritage and the way citizens included the mausoleums into their daily life. The mausoleums have been restored. What's left is a monument, the mosque, and manuscripts. The next phase of the restoration will start in October after the rainy season ends, but Hassay cannot say how long the project will actually take. UNESCO is attempting to raise 11 million to help restore Timbuktu's cultural treasures. 6 months after announcing the project, UNESCO has raised only $3 million, less than one-third of the goal. Katerina Höje for VOA News, Timbuktu.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehia Yusuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The leading opponent to President Alpha Conde's re-election bid in Guinea has withdrawn from the race and charged fraud in last Sunday's vote. Niger declares a state of emergency in its southeastern region bordering Nigeria, often targeted by Boko Haram militants. And at least 8 migrants and refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea today when their wooden boat collided with a Greek Coast Guard vessel. Coming up, we'll have music from Mali. And in our feature segment, teachers in Cameroon working under difficult conditions are trying to meet the educational needs of Central African refugees. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheyas Wuheeb, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Of course, it's time now for sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga, sitting in for Sonny Young. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we'll kick off with football.
Okay.
Thank you very much. FIFA's Prince Albin Al Hussein of Jordan has announced his candidacy for the upcoming FIFA presidential election, vying to become the head of the embattled global governing body for soccer. Prince Ali, a former FIFA vice president, made his announcement today, saying he's confident that the organization can emerge from its corruption scandal with its reputation restored. He said FIFA needs the right leadership to help it regain credibility. He said he has the backing of 5 member associations, which is required to run, but he declined to specify which ones they were. Prince Ali stood as a challenger in the May leadership election to then-incumbent Sepp Blatter, but withdrew after the first round. Blatter stepped down 4 days later over the corruption scandal that erupted earlier this year. Several other possible contenders for the top slot are dealing with corruption allegations that have resulted in suspensions. FIFA has been embroiled in scandal after 14 FIFA officials were arrested in Zurich in May and charged in the United States with nearly 50 counts of corruption, including racketeering, wire fraud, and money laundering. Swiss officials have also opened a separate criminal investigation involving FIFA's selection of Russia and Qatar to host the World Cup tournament in 2018 and 2022, respectively.
You want to listen to the latest African music? Just tune in to the African Beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays at exactly 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
African Beat. We love it.
I feel good.
But right now, you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports, so check it out. Now wait till they be so.
10 players from the Eritrean football team have refused to return home after playing a World Cup qualifier match in Botswana and are now seeking asylum there, according to officials. The men were detained by police after deciding not to board their plane. They are reported to have refused to go home despite the intervention of the Eritrean ambassador in Botswana. There have been a number of mass defections by Eritrean athletes in recent years. One of the most noticeable was in 2013 when Uganda granted asylum to 15 Eritrean players and their team doctor after they absconded at the end of a football tournament. A senior official at the Botswana Football Association says it has yet to establish why the players refused to leave with their teammates. However, a report in the Botswana newspaper The Voice said the players were distressed about the prospect of joining the Eritrean army and wanted to seek asylum despite being persuaded not to by the ambassador. The newspaper reported Botswana Football Association Vice President Basadi Akosayase as saying that the Eritrean players were found missing from their hotel rooms early on Wednesday morning by team officials.
Stop!
This is the Sunny Side of Sports coming to you live from Washington. Now for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma. Mark begins with cricket.
Uganda opened their campaign against the United States of America at the ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup qualifiers in Pandamaran, Malaysia today, Thursday. Tomorrow, Friday, they face Nepal before engaging Papua New Guinea in Kinara on Sunday. On Monday, they complete the round-robin phase of the contest against Ireland. Initially set for April in Nepal, the tournament was rescheduled and taken to Malaysia following the devastating earthquake that ravaged Nepal. The winner of this playoff qualifies for the 2016 ICC Under-19 Cricket World Cup in Bangladesh. Turning to football, South Africa held hosts Honduras to a 1-1 draw in San Pedro on Tuesday, while Swaziland host Djibouti in the return leg of their preliminary Africa 2018 FIFA World Cup qualifier in Lobambo on Saturday. Swaziland won the first leg 6-0 in Djibouti City. Meanwhile, Burundi host Ethiopia in Bujumbura in the opening leg of the penultimate round in the African Nations Championship CHAN qualifiers on Saturday. Mali play Mauritania while the Democratic Republic of Congo engages the Central African Republic. Elsewhere, Niger welcome Togo to Niamey. Cameroon play the Republic of Congo. Zambia face Mozambique. Guinea engage Senegal. And Chad encounter Gabon. On Sunday, Zimbabwe host Lesotho in Bulawayo. Nigeria welcome Burkina Faso in Port Harcourt, River State. And Ghana engage the visiting Ivory Coast in Kumasi. In basketball, Algeria is Africa's most improved men's basketball team, while Cameroon has slipped by the widest margin following the recent Africa Olympic qualifiers, the World Basketball Governing Body FIBA disclosed in Mainz, Switzerland. Ranked 15th, Angola is the highest placed African team. Tunisia is 23rd, while African champions Nigeria are 25th. Senegal is 31st, Ivory Coast 40th, Egypt 41st, Cameroon 52nd, while Central African Republic and Mali share 57th spot and Morocco is 60th. Meanwhile, following the recent Olympic qualifiers, Egypt is the most improved women's team, while Cape Verde Islands slipped by the widest margin. Ranked 18th, Angola is Africa's highest ranked female team. Mali is 19th, African champions Senegal are 24th, Mozambique 28th, Cameroon 39th, Nigeria 42nd, Ivory Coast 53rd, Egypt 60th, Rwanda 61st, and Guinea 62nd.
That was Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game.
And in athletics, Ethiopia's Hisai Lema Kasaye, winner of this year's Vienna City Marathon, and his compatriot Koren Jalela Yar will be two high-quality additions to the elite field for the Frankfurt Marathon on Sunday, October 25th. That's according to organizers of the IAAF Gold Label Road Race. The 24-year-old Ethiopian, who began his career at the age of 17, running barefoot for lack of running shoes, achieved a big breakthrough this year after he had already impressed when winning the 2013 Warsaw Marathon in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 2 seconds. He began 2015 in fine style with 5th place and a personal best of 2 hours, 7 minutes and 6 seconds in the Dubai Marathon in January. In the Austrian capital in April, Lema broke away from the field at 27 kilometers and won by almost 5 minutes in 2 hours, 7 minutes and 31 seconds, the biggest victory of his career so far. Meanwhile, the 28-year-old Jalela returned to competition earlier this year after maternity leave and not racing at all internationally during the past 2 years. Her goal in Frankfurt will be to get close to her best of 2 hours, 22 minutes and 43 seconds set when winning the Toronto Marathon in 2011, which also ranks her as the fastest woman in the Frankfurt elite field. Other notable successes for Jalera include winning the 2011 Mumbai Marathon and the Istanbul Marathon title a year later.
VOA. I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
In South Africa, Olympic and Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius, jailed for killing his girlfriend, is to be freed from prison to house arrest next Tuesday. That's according to a South African parole board. In a trial that made headlines around the world, Pistorius was jailed last year for killing his girlfriend, a model and a law graduate. He was found guilty of culpable homicide or manslaughter after saying he shot her through a locked bathroom door because he mistook her for an intruder. The prosecution has appealed, saying he should instead be convicted of murder. That case is expected to be heard on November 3rd. Pistorius has spent 12 months in jail and will now spend the rest of his sentence under what is termed in South Africa as correctional supervision, the parole board said. Once a poster boy for Paralympic sport, Pistorius, known as the Blade Runner, rose to global fame when he raced against able-bodied competitors in the 2012 London Olympics.
This is Larry Zamuze, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station. Of course, we partner the VOA.
VOA!
And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thanks, Dr. Larry. In addition to Sports Radio, 88.9 Brilla FM stations in Lagos and Abuja, Dr. Larry also has stations in Kaduna and Onitsha, Nigeria. We're delighted to be your partner, Dr. Larry, so keep it sporty.
The Voice of America, VOA.
And just before we go, in tennis, Andy Murray came from a sit-down to beat John Isner and reach the quarterfinals of the Shanghai Masters. The British world number two, who is 28, showed excellent resilience in the face of the America's powerful serving to win 6-7, 4-7, 6-4, 6-4. And Johanna Konta saved six match points but lost 6-3, 7-5 to Madison Brengo in the second round of the Linz Open. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, listen to an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, teachers in Cameroon working under difficult conditions trying to meet the educational needs of Central African refugees. And next, what a return to political stability can do for Burkina Faso's economic recovery. But first, some music. Here is Salif Keita of Mali with Tekere.
tegero fonye mosolu tegero folangu beka tegero fo pie manadi jeli keba basewa tengoro tegero befo
tegere 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 tegere
muidi nanema muidi ni mankani yomere monele muidi monelalema muye monema furu yomere neme na yoli yoli le ite dala kama dini kie dala kasanka Banadi moju ya bangila fumo kake na juya
Ne bangila ne juya
Bani jene kake na juya
Ne bangila ne juya
Bani mesi kake na juya
Ne bangila ne juya
Solo mani kake na juya
Ne bangila ne juya
Bateri fola kake na juya
Ne bangila ne juya
Latumba fola kake na juya
Ne bangila ne juya
Julu fola
Salif Keita of Mali with Tekere.
Well, some teachers in Cameroon work under difficult classroom conditions. The teachers are trying to meet the educational needs of many Central African students in Eastern Cameroon schools. The students are refugees from sectarian violence in their own country. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Garoua Bulaye on the CAR border.
Class, stop noise. Stop noise.
Emmanuel Mbizinyoyi asks students to be quiet and follow English language classes here at the government school in Dauhong in eastern Cameroon. 80 of the 110 students in one class are Central African Republic refugee children. The CAR students know French but are trained in both French and English in these Cameroonian schools.
It's really difficult. You get into a class, you see children who cannot express themselves in English. At times you use terms in class and they are like, sir, what does that mean? We have never heard that word. Because at home, their parents are Francophones. They speak but French. In school, that's where they can even manage to speak the English language. And even among themselves, they speak but the French language.
I am introduced to Belingak Christophe, who I am told fled violence in Bangui, CAR's capital last year, and is now the brightest English student in his class. I decided to test his proficiency in English. He says he is now able to say certain things in English. For example, that his name is Belinga and that he can now say he is hungry. thanks to his English language teacher. Emmanuel Mbidzinyoi is the lone English language teacher in the school with an enrollment of 1,350 students. He says most of the refugee children attend classes only once in a while as they struggle for survival.
They are hawkers, night hawkers, by the roadside. They sell bread in order to pay for their fees and other school needs. At times, you are even with children in class, they don't have uniforms. When they're asking, they say, no, my father doesn't have. Even in class, at times, they're unable to, like, study because they'll tell you they're hungry, they have not eaten things in the morning.
Cameroon teachers face enormous challenges. They are often transferred to difficult-to-access areas after training and at times go for months without salaries. Some work in congested classrooms and others have to grapple with insecurity in areas like Eastern Cameroon. Cameroon Teachers Trade Union, CATU Secretary General Tassan Wilfred, says despite the challenges, many of them are committed to the work.
We send out a clarion call for teachers to love the profession and to teach the children the nation has put at their disposal with all their energy, in spite of the very sometimes harsh conditions in which most of us have to work. Because if we continue to look on the pay package and the conditions in which we work for some of us in some areas, we would not do the job. So with this kind of thing, we look at the plight of the children, their future seems bleak.
UNESCO says despite Cameroon's efforts, there are more than 53,000 CAR refugee children in Cameroon who lack schools and teachers. The theme of this year's World Teachers' Day in Cameroon is empowering teachers and building sustainable societies. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Garoua Boulaye, Cameroon.
In Burkina Faso, the economy has suffered from recent political turmoil. The transitional government of President Michel Kafando is reporting the loss of nearly $70 million in the 10-day coup earlier this month. The political and military crisis shut businesses as workers went on strike. Emilia Yub reports on what a return to political stability can do for the country's economic recovery.
This market in Burkina Faso's capital city, Ouagadougou, is buzzing with activity again after recovering from a failed coup earlier in September that paralyzed the activity for more than a week. Ibrahim Ouadraogo is a hawker and says during the coup he could not work.
We couldn't go out to sell because soldiers were in the streets, so we couldn't go out of our homes.
The country's borders were closed for a few days. A lot of workers went on strike to protest the coup. Hélène Traoré-Sanou works at a cotton company. Burkina Faso is the top cotton producer in Africa, and cotton is a heavyweight in the country's economy. Traoré says her business has not been affected by the recent crisis, but it will be if there is unrest during the upcoming presidential elections, which are due to happen later this year.
Nous avons près de 900 camions.
We have close to 900 trucks driving around the country to fetch the cotton, so we really need the roads to be functional in order to get the cotton to our factory.
This is the latest political crisis in months of turmoil in the West African nation. 1 year ago, massive protests ousted President Blaise Compaoré after 27 years in power. A transitional government was put in place in order to organize elections. Fiscal lawyer Daouda Diallo says these political changes have affected the trust investors had in Burkina and that upcoming elections are crucial.
New authorities will have to give some sort of guarantee to the international community, not only to help them decide to bring funds to Burkina Faso, but also to attract investors in order to take charge of the country's economy again.
Earlier this year, the IMF projected a 5% growth for Burkina in 2015, 2 points below previous projections. Emily Yop for VOA News from Ouagadougou.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
October 16th is World Food Day, a day of action against hunger. The date commemorates the founding in 1945 of the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO. On this day, people around the world come together to declare their commitment to eradicate hunger in our lifetime. Over the past decade or so, we have seen a great reduction of people living with hunger on a nearly daily basis. Back then, about 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Now it's about 1 in every 9. Nonetheless, that still leaves some 795,000 chronically hungry people around the world. Of these, 60% are women, and this despite the fact that most small farmers living in the developing world are women. And when women go hungry, so all too often do children. About 161 million kids under the age of 5 are malnourished. This means that their brains won't develop normally. They may have difficulties learning, and their physical and cognitive growth is stunted. Lack of nutrition compromises not only their own success in the future, but also the development of the communities, economies, and countries in which they live. In addition to those children who are chronically undernourished, almost 5 million children under the age of 5 die of malnutrition-related causes every year. The global community is working to eradicate hunger because it is the right thing to do. The first of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals called for halving the proportion of people suffering from hunger and facing extreme poverty. We have achieved that goal. As we transition to a sustainable development agenda for 2030, we have raised our ambitions and are striving to effectively end hunger and extreme poverty altogether. The United States aids this effort through its innovative Feed the Future initiative. We partner with country governments, many universities, multilateral and non-governmental organizations, transnational organizations like the UN, research communities, and the private sector to lift millions of vulnerable people out of hunger and poverty. On World Food Day, the United States reaffirms its commitment to the fight against poverty, hunger, and undernutrition.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Straight Talk Africa. Host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the upcoming elections in Africa and consider what makes an election credible to the extent that it reflects the will of the people. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, turncoat. According to the dictionary, the word turncoat means a person who stops being a member of one group in order to join another group that opposes the first group. Do you want to know more? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing Turncoat. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.